Because the more of us who do, it'll be safer for all of us.
Valerie Costa, I want to thank you for being with us, an activist with the Tesla takedown movement, speaking to us from Seattle, Washington. We just reconnected with Gaza. We'll try to return to our conversation with the two doctors in Khan Yunis, Gaza. They are Dr. Feroz Sidwa and Dr. Mark Perlmutter. Dr. Sidwa, you're meeting with the UN Secretary General and demanding to know or pushing for information on where Dr. Abu Safiya is, the head of the Kamel Adwan Pediatric Hospital.
Yes, Dr. Abu Safiya was taken after Kamel Adwan had been laid siege to for 80 or 90 days. The entire hospital has been completely destroyed at this point. And he's just a pediatrician, nothing special about him. He was actually taken by the Israelis earlier in the war and let go precisely because he's not a threat to anybody. But then they decided to arrest him again, decided to torment him as well, just like they have with so many others. But yes, we were able to meet with Antonio Guterres, the Secretary General of the UN, as well as Tom Fletcher, the Undersecretary General for OCHA. Secretary General Guterres was very interested in the case. He asked Mr. Fletcher to look into it, which he did. Mr. Fletcher raised the issue with the Israelis, met with Dr. Abu Safiya's family quite publicly, actually. And still no word on Dr. Abu Safiya's release date. The Israelis keep pushing back his court dates and things like that. But we're very much hoping that he will be released soon. This territory needs every doctor, every nurse that it can possibly muster. It's true that the bombs have stopped falling and most of the shooting has stopped. The Israelis are still killing about half a dozen people a day. But the bombing has, thank God, stopped for the most part. But everyone here is still homeless. Everyone here is still hungry. Everyone here is still thirsty. And as you mentioned at the beginning of the hour, the Israelis have cut off all entry and exit to Gaza again. You've got 1.8, 1.9, 2 million people locked in a cage, and they can't access anything from the outside world. They can't survive like this. People are turning on each other here. Palestinian society is very communal and very... there's a lot of solidarity in it, but there's limits to everything. Just last night, we actually had a mass shooting between two different families over what, who knows, but people are just at their breaking point with the necessities of life just being unavailable, not for a week or a month or a year, but for 16 months now. It has to end, and what the United States is doing about this is just shameful. It's backing Israel all the way. It's got to stop. It's got to stop.
And the complete cutting off of aid now into Gaza, which has been condemned by humanitarian groups around the world, Dr. Sidwa?
I'm here with Med Global. It's a group that brings doctors in. But even though I was able to get in, half of my own group was denied entry. So only two out of the five doctors that were scheduled to come are here now. Dr. Perlmutter, your hand surgery colleague was also denied entry. What is being allowed in and not being allowed in? Who is being allowed in and not allowed in? It just seems to be completely random and arbitrary. And it's wreaking havoc on the whole society. I mean, again, the whole, people can't survive with nothing. That's not how human life works. And if the United States needs to stop backing this insane isolation of 2 million people, half of whom are children, most of whom are refugees, they didn't do anything to anybody. Just stop treating them this way.
I want to thank you both for being with us, Dr. Feroz Sidwa and Dr. Mark Perlmutter, both U.S.-based surgeons back in Gaza to volunteer. They're currently volunteering at the Nasser Medical Complex in Khan Yunis. To see the full interview, you can go to the beginning of our show as we lost connection with them repeatedly throughout the broadcast. And to see Dr. Sidwa's op-ed in the New York Times, we'll link to it at Democracy Now! .org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
stations. We can secure our world. When you choose your passwords, make them strong. Use a password manager to help you along. Learn how to use strong passwords at cisa.gov/secureourworld.
Hey, look, everyone, it's Mando.
Everybody ready?
Well, hello there, everybody, and welcome to Whiskey Before Breakfast Radio or the Roots Program, depending on where you are listening. I am Manda Richard. Thank you all so much for tuning in. We've got a special guest who's lurking in the doorway right now, and we've got an interview with Heather Pearson to play. We got all sorts of good stuff, but as usual, we'll start off on the liquored up side of the family. Here comes Candy Dancer.
Come on, all you booze fighters, if you want to hear about the kind of booze that we sell around here. It's made way back in the swamps and the hills, where there's plenty of moonshine stills, where we don't give a damn for the Volstead law. And for prohibition, we don't care a straw. It's made out of buckwheat, rye, and corn, all bottled up in some barn. And the lamb will lay down with the lion after drinking this old moonshine. Tip up your head and take a little drink. Then for a week you won't be able to think. First thing you know, you'll be getting kind of tired, out on the street trying to raise a fight. Tip up your head and take a little more. Then for a month you'll be feeling kind of sore. Then you'll swear you won't drink it anymore. But you've said that 1,000 times before. And the lamb will lay down with the lion after drinking this old moonshine. One drop will make a rabbit whip a bulldog. One drop will make a cat chase a wild hog. Make a bullfrog spit in a black snake's face. And make a hard shell preacher fall from grace. And the lamb will lay down with the lion
after drinking this old moonshine.
Prohibition is a failure, as anyone can see, for whiskey is sold in every town in the good old USA. Oh, the policeman will arrest you, he'll lock you up in jail, he'll drink up all your liquor and turn you out on bail. Back to Georgia to join the drinking clan, where whiskey's made of red seal and sold in old tin cans. Where the men they drink and gamble, and the women quarrel and fight, and the saloons they run wide open, and a man's killed every night. Mountains, they operate for stills. They're true blue to each other. What they say they'll do, they will. They all carry six shooters, shotguns and bowie knives. And the man who tries to rave them, is sure to lose his life. Anyone can learn. He takes a can of old malt syrup and an old-fashioned churn. He adds a cake of yeast or two, and he lets it work and foam. And a bottle or two on a Saturday night, he'll sing my home sweet home. We'll have light wines and good old beer in 1933. And if we do not get it, I'm telling you and you, we'll make our old home liquor and drink our old home brew.
I found hope in the midst of an overwhelming situation.
Alcoholism is a disease that can affect any family. Everyone suffers, but there is help and hope at Al-Anon Family Groups.
Al-Anon gave me my life back. I'm a better father and husband.
Are you in an overwhelming situation because of someone else's drinking?
Al-Anon and Alateen can help.
Local and virtual meetings are available. Maybe one could work for you. Call 1-866-200-0033 or visit alanon.org/hope.
Good evening, friends. You're listening to Whiskey Before Breakfast with Mandolin Richard. No, it's Mando Richard, isn't it?
For sure.
Cut! I don't do well under pressure, people! Give him a quart. Hello, friends. Brian Oberlin here. You're listening to Whiskey Before Breakfast with Mando Richard, the finest name in all the mandolin business.
Very good.
Chicken and empty glass. Stop
In the background, you're listening to Jerry Douglas, Russ Barenberg, and Edgar Meyer play the Big Bug Shuffle from that old record there, Skip Hop and Wobble. Geez, when did this come out? Well, of course, there it is, 1993. And now it's time for me to tell you about our liquored upset, and then we'll introduce our guest and get on with business. We began the set with Candy Dancer doing Booze Fighters from the compilation The Appalachians, which is the soundtrack to a TV special, I do believe. Then the new Lost City Ramblers gave us Low Stokes' Prohibition is a Failure from their 1962 record American Moonshine and Prohibition Songs. And then from that compilation I've been known to play tracks from time to time, Cheap Old Wine and Whiskey, you heard Jimmy Rainey and Slim Slaughter do You Drink Too Much Booze. Are you ready for our folk rock set? I'm going to let my guest, Christopher Mark Jones, introduce the first song in the folk rock set.
Okay, this one was recorded in 1978 in the Yorkshire Dales for Transatlantic Records with Bill Leader. That's more information than you need to know. But, of course, having lived in Europe for about 8 years by that point, I was writing about the American Midwest, of course. This one's about the Dust Bowl. It's called Dust to Dust.
Singing to the rhythm of the pots and pans. Now, he cast his eye about. Then he looks over in the amen corner. All the sisters come at the shout.
What'd he say?
He said a married man's a fool to think that his wife loves nobody else but his deal. She's stick by you all of your life. Chances is mighty slim.
Now you read the good book, chapter 21. Every married woman got to have a little fun. Read on over. Chapter 22 is a sin to let that woman make a fool out of you. Now you read a little further. Chapter 23, she two-time you, brother, like she double-crossed me. Read on back. Over chapter 10, shimmy one time, she got to wobble again. Cause
a man that's a fool to think that his wife loves nobody else but him. I mean, loves nobody else but him.
Page. Married women's law is hard to engage. Read kind of careful, chapter 26. Back door slamming, you got to learn to get it fixed. Read on out, chapter 28. Who's that backsliding out through your back gate? I believe I close in chapter 29.
Woman gets out of the same man all the time.
Cause a
man's a fool, think that his wife love nobody else but him. I mean, love nobody else but him.
When they fall.
up on the scaffolding, 200 feet off the ground, painting dreams on the side of the building, but don't ever look down, never look down, never look down, don't look down, down.
then from Big Medicine's 2004 record Fever in the South, you're hearing Sharp's three-way hornpipe. That'll be the musical bed while Christopher and I tell you about that last set of music here on Whiskey Before Breakfast Radio or The Roots Program. We went back to 1977 or so for Christopher Jones himself singing
Dust to Dust
from his old album No Range to Roam.
And no more range to roam. I guess nostalgia for the Far West must have been. That's the metaphor.
But yeah, and you were actually in England at the time.
I was in England at the time, yes. And it was recorded, of course, in the Yorkshire Dales. For those of you who watch All Things Great and Small, that was the view out the studio window, those hillsides.
Wow. All right, well, Christopher, thank you so much for coming in. I better tell people about the rest of that folk rock set. Rye Cooter doing Willie McTell's Married Man's a Fool from his 1970 record Paradise and Lunch. The database reported as 1974, but I know it came out in 1970. And then we heard from Annie and Rod Capps doing When They Fall, the title track to a 2019 record of theirs. And they are coming to Pittsburgh on April 4th for
Sunny Hill Live.
That's right.
On Washington Road in Mount Lebanon.
And then the last song on the set was Fairport Convention with Sandy Denny. This was after she split from the group, and then she came back for a little while. It was a live concert at Ebbets Field in Brooklyn in 1974. And they did Bob Dylan's Down in the Flood.
Before I sign off and go home, I'd like to thank Richard Gordon for having me into the studio to promote music we both appreciate, and for everything else that he does, especially in favor of local music. But he is, of course, aware of music happening around the country and promotes many artists who we know and love but won't be found mostly on commercial radio. So
about never.
And now, Ustad Ali Akbar Khan Sarod, Indranil Bhattacharya Sitar, and Zakir Hussain Tabla will perform Rags Kafi Jila Kafi, followed by Rag Bhairavi.
So that is some of Whiskey Before Breakfast by Amanda Richard, which we will be getting back to later with an interview by Heather Pearson. So please consider staying tuned for that. But right now I have a special thing that we're doing today, which is that I am interviewing Commander Hoffman. So hello, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So just to get us started, can you tell us a little about, you know, your life, your career? How did you end up here?
So I'm kind of coming full circle right now. So I'm a Carnegie Mellon graduate, class of 2004. With my bachelor's degree, I studied over at Dietrich College. I was a philosophy and European studies major, and then I stayed on for my master's degree, completing a master's in philosophy, doing research in game theory in 2005. I commissioned in the Navy via the Navy ROTC program from here in 2005, and have spent roughly the last 20 years as a surface warfare officer. Now I have the chance to come back to town to kind of share some of my stories with Carnegie Mellon, with Central Catholic, my other alma mater, just right across the street from here, as well as just kind of talk up the Navy in Pittsburgh. Three rivers, not much ocean. So I want to make sure people are aware of that we have a Navy and what we can do.
So from what I understand, you studied philosophy.
Correct.
I feel like that's not the most expected path, potentially. How did that shape your perspective?
I did it for a couple reasons that I felt very relevant going into it. And I think still 20 years on, I still feel very relevant that and very rewarded that I was able to pursue that. So one of the advantages of the Navy ROTC program, it's a very generous scholarship. It was back then. It's even more so now. So if you're any juniors out there hearing this, it might be something you might look into. So because I knew that, A, I had my college paid for in part by the Navy, and B, I had a job waiting for me on the back end of it, I decided to study something that was my passion. Grew up always being a history and liberal arts guy, love classic literature, love learning about different cultures, different societies, languages, et cetera, et cetera. And, especially from having been a 12-year Catholic school veteran, I was exposed to the Western philosophical tradition, kind of the Western heritage thing there too. And I found that philosophy was really kind of the underpinnings of everything else. If I had a good idea of philosophy, I had a good sense of the human condition, why people do the things that they do, what their incentives are, what motivates them. And that branches off into a better understanding of the other liberal arts and sciences that I like, why literature was written the way it was, why certain stories compel us, why history played out the way it did, why people made the decisions they did that caused conflict or maybe resolved conflicts. So because of that, I really enjoyed studying philosophy. I jumped in as a philosophy major as a freshman, never changed my major. As a dual major, like I said, philosophy and European studies, so that way I could get my languages and literature and art done as well. I played around with some other things as well as an undergraduate. I tried to do, almost made it through doing pre-med prerequisites, but then being a Navy doctor seemed like it was going to take a lot of time out of my career, which is kind of ironic now that I've been in for 20 and a 12-year service commitment spooked me a little bit as an undergraduate. I also played around with an international relations minor for a while, did a couple classes towards that, but I ended up doing those two majors that I came in to do and then ended up finding the program where I could complete a 2 years master's program here with just 1 year. And game theory was, once again, more of the same, more math than I ever thought that I could do myself. But it was, once again, it was a good insight into the human conditioning. Because my research was in preference formation. When you both have complete information, you know what you're going to get at the end. You know your risks and your rewards, as well as incomplete information, which is kind of more realistic. Sometimes we don't know what the risks and rewards are, and to try and explore that. And so then I go into the fleet, and I often get asked by my sailors, my colleagues, hey, 2 degrees in philosophy, huh? And you're a surface warfare officer. How does that work? How do you use those degrees? I say, kind of cynically, but kind of not, I use them every single day. I think being a liberal arts guy kind of gives me an edge when it comes to leadership and management. So you hear about the Navy and the Air Force, particularly amongst our armed services, as being technical branches. And that, by and large, is true. Ships are extraordinarily complex pieces of machinery. But they just sit there if there aren't people there to operate them. And as a junior officer, I learned soon and then further got reinforced as a department head, then as executive officer, and now as commanding officer, it's all about the people. If you know how people tick, you're a more effective leader, you're a more effective manager. And I feel like my humanities background, my liberal arts background, kind of gives me a little bit of a leg up because I'm able to ask those questions and see why and see what motivates people to get the mission done. It's not just a bunch of cogs and wheels in the engineering plant. Though that's a lot of fun too, but it's all about the sailors, those men and women that are operating the engineering plant and what they're expecting to get out of life and what they're expecting to get out of there. Because if you can appeal to them as human beings, then they're that much more motivated to get the mission done.
That gives me a lot of hope as a fellow Dietrich humanities student. People keep asking me, how's that going to help? So you said that the Navy is technical, and you're in philosophy. Is there any reason you picked the Navy? Because there are other armed forces, obviously.
Well, I'm enough of a traditionalist that I joke that if the Army still had horse-drawn cavalry, I would probably have done the Army. But it was really, a lot of it was just because the Navy is a very traditional-minded organization. I mean, we use nautical terms like port and starboard. The wall is not a wall, it's a bulkhead. The floor is not the floor, it's a deck. It's kind of its own little subculture. I always found that fascinating growing up. Didn't have too many people in my family that did military service, but I did grow up on a steady diet of war movies. My mom was always a classic Hollywood person. So whether that was Away All Boats, In Harm's Way, The Longest Day, Das Boot. Just grew up around war movies. And same thing, Errol Flynn, pirate movies, sailing, swashbuckling. It's just going to sea and having those adventures always really appealed to me. And then as I found out, it was like, oh, the Navy still does a lot of those things. So that's kind of what gravitated me towards it.
What would you say are some common misconceptions people might have about life in the Navy?
I'll talk about a couple right now. One is that you have to be a really good swimmer to be in the Navy. You actually don't have to know how to swim at all.
At all?
At all. No. There's a very simple swim test that all sailors must pass. It's generally given for enlisted sailors once they get to boot camp early on after they graduate from high school, for those in officer programs fairly early on into their academy or their university experience. And it basically tests whether you can float and not drown. And if you can't even do that, we'll teach you. As a surface warfare guy, I'm on ships all the time. If I find myself in the water, something's gone horribly, horribly wrong, and I got bigger problems than worrying about how to swim well.
All right. Any other ones?
Another one is that we're at sea all the time, and we never see land. And I talk about this every time I go visit a school because I get that from a lot of students. And I have to explain to them that, yes, when you're assigned to a ship, you're assigned to that ship. But it works a three-year plan called a training cycle, an optimized fleet replacement plan, where they go and it's almost like a sports season where you have a maintenance phase where you're in port just getting the ship upgraded and getting it maintained, in which case, unless you're on duty and have to man the ship overnight, you go home at the end of every day. Then you do a training phase where basically for a destroyer, they have 23 different mission sets that they have to qualify in. Think like 23 different classes or 23 different subjects, each of which has a final exam. So not really fun, but a lot of quick going to sea for a couple days here, a couple days there until you get all done. You go to sea a little bit longer and longer until you go on deployment, which could be anywhere from maybe 6 to 8 months on average. And just because it's 6 to 8 months doesn't mean, yes, you're going to be away from your home port for 6 to 8 months, but doesn't mean you're going to be floating in the middle of the ocean for 6 to 8 months. We need to get on fuel. We need to get new personnel on, old personnel off, take on supplies, get food, because sailors like to eat a lot, and more importantly, show the flag in other foreign countries. So it's actually a strategic priority of ours to visit countries. And sailors get that benefit because we get to see all sorts of cool places around the world. I personally have been to every continent except for Antarctica because of the Navy, based off of various things that I've done. And so when we pull into a port on deployment, it's generally, we do that maybe once every 2 or 3 weeks, give or take, and then we're there for about 4 days. One of those days you have to work. The other 3 days are on your own to sightsee with your friends.
Wow. So if you're not at sea all the time, I know you're a commander, so I assume you've got a lot of responsibility still. What would your day-to-day look like?
Are you talking about like on a ship or right now? Because recruiting is a lot different. I'm the commanding officer of the recruiting district in the Southwest.
Well, can you tell me about that?
Okay, cool. So my day recruiting, the day of a recruiter generally starts a little bit later than the day of a sailor on sea because we try and map our work days with the general populace, when schools are in session, when people could come in and interview, do their job interviews, get information about their jobs, maybe for some of the younger people, bring in their parents to answer parents' questions because we get the parents on board and say, hey, look at all this money you can make, look at all these benefits, look at these cool places you can go. They're more apt to convince their young adult son or daughter to say, hey, you might not realize this now, 17, 18-year-old, but it really is a good deal. So our day starts around in earnest really around 9 o'clock, and we run until about 6 o'clock at night. Some of my sailors stay a little later if maybe their applicant or their applicant's family can only get off work and talk maybe later in the evening or maybe even on a weekend morning. A lot of times my sailors are supporting community events into the evening or on the weekend, state fairs, farmers markets, going to their local high school football game, you know, just raising Navy awareness in the community. On sea duty, it looks a little bit different. Typical day for me on sea was I generally get to the base pretty early, sometimes even between 6 and 7 in the morning. Especially as a more junior officer, I didn't have a reserved parking space, and try and find parking at 32nd Street Naval Base in San Diego, which is the most ships that we have in one place.
Oh, no.
You're on Pier 2, but you end up parking all the way back by the base chapel and walking 20 minutes to work. So it behooves you to get to work early. And it also allows you to, you know, kind of have a relaxed start of your day. Grab a cup of coffee, check email, check in with your guys, get ready for the morning set of meetings. Workday really starts in earnest on a ship around maybe 7 o'clock in the morning in port. clean the ship, do some quick inspections, walk arounds and everything, and then jump right into the day's maintenance or the day's training. That normally wraps up about early to mid-afternoon, so the more junior sailors, those whose duties just are standing watch or doing maintenance, once they do their day's work, they go home. More supervisory people, chief petty officers, officers, generally use that mid to late afternoon as a chance to take a look at paperwork just because there's not active maintenance going on. There's normally a sixth of the crew that stays on board for duty overnight to stand fire watches, force protection, security watches overnight, just to make sure that the ship stays safe and nothing bad happens overnight.
All right. So in terms of your career, is there something you're proudest of? I know this is a really hard question, so you can pick a couple if you prefer.
It is. So each of my tours has had a pretty good highlight. So my first ship, I was out in Japan. So I moved from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania to Yokosuka, Japan in summer 2005 once I finished my master's degree. And that was something I found out when I was a sophomore in college here in ROTC, that we had such a thing as ships in Japan. And as soon as I found that out, I'm like, that's what I want to do. I always had kind of, I was not one of those anime guys, but I always had like a great admiration for Japanese culture. And I love Japanese food. And tell you what, as much as good as the sushi place in Shadyside is, it's not sushi in Tokyo. So that was definitely a great opportunity. I got to do some really neat things while I was on USS Fitzgerald, that first ship. One of the highlights of that tour was near the end of my 2.5 years on board, I had qualified enough, the ship trusted me enough, that I was a surface warfare coordinator and launched 2 Harpoon anti-ship cruise missiles at one of our old ships that was decommissioned that we're using as a target for an exercise called Valiant Shield. And yes, both missiles hit. So that was one of the highlights of my first ship. Since then, all my other sea commands were out of San Diego, so I've always been a Pacific Fleet guy. So don't ask me about any Europe port visits that generally the East Coast ships get to do. So I'm a little bummed out that I didn't get to do that.
You got Japan though.
I did live in Japan, so that was good. And then I came back when I was an engineering inspector a couple times, and I came back when I was a personnel officer for my admiral. And I'm trying to use any excuse to go back to Japan on official travel. And I still have my frequent sushi club card for the carousel sushi place by the Yokosuka Chuo train station in Yokosuka. Highly recommend it if you're in that area. With that, my second ship was kind of cool. It was an amphibious assault ship, so it carried Marines, USS Boxer. It was about the same size as the Titanic, 40,000-ton displacement, 800 feet long, about 1,000 crew, about 1,000 Marines on board. We did a counter-piracy deployment off the Horn of Africa, which they eventually made a movie about called Captain Phillips with Tom Hanks.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was more of a... The movie, I'm not seeing the movie all the way through. It was definitely more of a human interest story of Tom Hanks playing this merchant captain that got captured by Somali pirates. And the SEALs came in and rescued him. And there was a little bit of Navy in there, too. But my ship, Boxer, was the flagship for that operation. And so we had the lifeboat that he was riding in on our flight deck to bring back as evidence against the one pirate that survived the SEALs' fusillade of gunfire, and we brought him back to New York so he could face trial. First trial for piracy in like 150 years. Couple other things I did was, as a department head, I deployed on the aircraft carrier Carl Vinson for 10 months. Remember I said 6 to 8 months is the norm. This was a longer than norm deployment. I was actually holding down 3 separate jobs with the destroyer squadron staff at the same time. I was training officer, I was combat systems officer, and I was future operations officer. And that was kind of a challenging deployment, not just out of its length and out of the sheer amount of work that I had to do, but it was also rewarding in a way because as future operations officer, I had to design exercises for our ships to do with foreign navies and just about every month and everything. And the highlight of that was I got to be the lead U.S. planner for a counter-piracy exercise with the Chinese Navy that we're normally not really cool with, but off the coast of Africa and off the coast of Yemen, where piracy is still very much a problem, that's something where we can find common ground between us and the Chinese. So I was able to design basically a day and a half long counter-piracy exercise. I rode a Chinese ship for an afternoon. We did gunnery exercises, boarding exercises. We landed a Chinese Z-9 helicopter on the back of a U.S. destroyer, which required a lot of paperwork to get that approval done. But it was, it was a lot of fun.
Wow! So you also mentioned that you worked in some engineering. How would you say the technology in the Navy has changed throughout your 20 years there?
Great question. So, and just to show you that the Navy is a versatile organization, and you learn a lot through doing, and you learn a lot through your senior enlisted experts on board. I was able to do 4 engineering tours of the Navy with 2 degrees in philosophy. So it can be done. And maybe it's like kind of the interdisciplinary thing that you learn here at Carnegie Mellon gives you an appreciation for other subjects and gives you a good underpinning such that you know what questions to ask, you know which questions to anticipate such that you can jump right into it. So my first engineering tour was on USS Boxer, which was actually kind of, you talk about new technology. This was very, very old technology, actually. While the Boxer was built in the 1990s, it's one of our last conventionally powered steamships.
Oh.
So it has 2 700 PSI combustion engineering boilers driving 2 steam turbines and 5 steam generators. So not only is the ship the same size as the Titanic, it basically uses the same engineering plant as the Titanic. Just Titanic had reciprocating engines, but they did have 1 steam turbine. And so that was kind of interesting to note, especially as a history guy, as I'm trying to learn this technology. And I found a historical document from the British Navy from 1916 about how to operate a steam plant that I found still relevant in teaching myself how to do it. So that was kind of neat as well. I saw pretty much all of it from old-fashioned steamships to the latest, almost hybrid ships. My next tour, I was an inspector for a group called Engineering Assessment Specific that would do light-off assessments and engineering operational certifications. So basically, your license to operate the engineering plant for safety and for proficiency all up and down the West Coast and also off in Japan. I came in to be a steam inspector. I qualified how to inspect diesel ships as well as gas turbine ships, so I saw a little bit of it all. And I saw some of the distinctions. And I'll give you a quick contrast here, too. So the LHD class, the amphibious assault ships, of which Boxer is one of them, the newer ones now have basically a hybrid drive. It's the same type of ship, but instead of boilers and steam turbines like how I was used to, they now have gas turbine engines, LM2500 pluses, as a main drive to take them from point A to point B. And then while they're just waiting around to launch the Marines and put the Marines ashore, they basically use an electric motor like a Tesla. They have giant Caterpillar diesel engines that feed electric motors, and they basically just, if they're going under 13 knots, they basically just troll there using electric power. It's a lot more efficient.
Oh, wow. What would you say is something that you've learned about leadership in the course of your career?
I've learned a lot of things about leadership, some of which is, and a lot of it's based off of just who I've worked for, both my immediate bosses as well as my captains. And especially as I got more senior, I got to work for some really talented officers that either were admirals or are now admirals. And so it's kind of a combination of cobbling together the things that I see that work, and I file those in the, hey, when I'm in charge of something, I make sure I do this. And as well as there are definitely instances and people I've worked for that have given me leadership lessons of what not to do. And remind me that when I'm in charge to never do that. So I think that what I found and kind of encapsulated it, what I brought basically from my philosophical background as well as what I've observed over Navy service to my current command is my current command leadership philosophy is all about equilibrium and striking a balance. We can only get to mission accomplishment if we balance professional excellence, such as doing your day job the correct way, being precise, asking a bunch of questions, following procedures, et cetera, with personal development, taking care of yourself, working on off-duty education, taking care of your family, focusing on your hobbies. All work and no play makes Jack a dull boy. And if you have those two in balance, then you're getting the mission done. If one of those is out of balance, then there's risk of the mission not getting done. Too much professional excellence, you're going to burn yourself out. Too much personal development, you're not getting the day job done.
Makes sense. So you said you've learned a lot about leadership. What else would you say you've really managed to develop over 20 years in the Navy? What skills does that bring?
I think it just reinforced a lot of study habits that I learned growing up and then certainly here at Carnegie Mellon. The Navy, and I'd say the military in general, but I'll probably pick on the Navy the most because that's what I know, is a very academic organization, right? So you generally get your first choice of duty station the better you do at whatever training class you had before then. You generally, when you're learning to do a new qualification on the ship, there is a bunch of technical manuals you have to read and a bunch of training that goes into that. And the better you are at learning it, the quicker you qualify. So I think it just kind of allowed me to double down on some of the practices that I already learned here as well as earlier in my academic career to know that that really matters. So that's something I encourage the newer officers and newer sailors to do is like, hey, there's a book answer for everything. It's all about asking for help and finding that book and then your own study habits. If you don't know how to study yet, ask somebody who is. Find that guy who's the first in your division to qualify something and to ask them what their secret is. How are they so quick at it? A lot of it has to do with time management too, is don't spin your wheels and try and figure it out. Ask for help.
Mm-hmm. So you got to do a lot of time management, cooperation, and mm-hmm. all that sort of thing?
Yeah, it definitely is a team sport. There's very little. One of the things, and not to pick on the Army because they no longer use this, but they used to have a slogan called an army of one, which I thought was kind of silly being in the military because there's very little. I mean, certainly you can control a lot yourself. And as somebody who's a fan of stoicism, I certainly admire that. But it all really is all about the team. Like, for example, the most basic unit in the Navy really is the ship or the command, that the aviation squadron, the submarine, whatever that is. And that's not an individual, right? The destroyer has about 330 crew. So that's a unit of 330 people. My command has about 220 people. So it's similar sized. And all the way up to an aircraft carrier that when you have the air wing embarked, it's 5,000 people. So it's really about what that group does together. You yourself... When you talk about that training cycle that I was just describing, it's the ship that's getting that grade for air and missile defense. It's not you as a watchstander. Certainly you contribute to it, but it's really about the collective whole. And I think that's a thing that takes a while for people to understand because as a junior sailor, you're really worried about your share of the maintenance and getting it done and your watch getting that done. As a junior officer, you're worried about your division, your qualifications, et cetera, et cetera. So I find that, and it's actually something that's kind of one of my challenges right now from a training and personnel development side with my own command, is taking the more junior leaders and getting them to kind of make that quantum leap from, hey, this is my individual efforts to, hey, now I'm part of a team, and now it's less of what I do and more of what the collective does.
Makes sense. On a lighter note, you said that you're in charge down in the Southwest.
Yes.
What do you miss about Pittsburgh?
Oh, everything. Everything from Permanis to green foliage to people that know how to drive to students that are actually engaged with their academics. It was so refreshing being back.
I'm so glad. Definitely people are locked into their academics.
That's for sure. The questions that I got both from the Carnegie Mellon ROTC crowd that I talked to yesterday as well as my over at my alma mater, Central Catholic, and my brother's alma mater of North Allegheny, they said some of the best, most insightful questions that I've ever heard from college students and high school students. In fact, I'm texting back to my immediate staff back in Phoenix being like, how come we don't get questions like this in Arizona and New Mexico?
What did they ask you?
So I got three quick examples. One is I'm at North Allegheny, and an underclassman, a freshman or a sophomore, asks me a question about dynamic versus passive leadership.
Oh.
At Central Catholic, now granted, as a Central Catholic Viking, I'm like, I would expect nothing less. I got a very detailed question about prioritizing which officer program should the student pursue for commission as a nuclear engineer, which is something that the college guys that apply for those programs in my area don't really know, and we have to explain to them the benefits. And he already knew it. Some of the questions I got from the ROTC midshipmen here were likewise insightful. They're not just thinking about their first division officer tour. They're thinking about setting themselves up for department head and beyond. And it's just really refreshing. So I personally always like to plan 5-10 years ahead, and I encourage everybody else to do that. And sometimes I have to look around and be like, well, why aren't you planning 5-10 years ahead? That should just be common sense. It should come naturally. And apparently it doesn't. And maybe I was just spoiled being in the Pittsburgh area and being at Carnegie Mellon, where everybody tends to think like that. I just assumed it was a given and forgot that this place is a very special place.
It is a very special place. What advice would you have for a college student or someone my age?
I would say just a couple things. So first of all, take academics seriously. A lot of it right now is because you don't have a whole lot of work experience to draw upon other than maybe random summer jobs, internship. Heck, I worked at the Giant Eagle when I was in high school. So really what you do in order to build your stock, in order to build your reputation, whatever you can do academically is going to make you stand out. So take your studies seriously and do that. Another thing I can encourage people to do is don't take yourself too seriously, though. I do a lot of scholarship interviews for the ROTC program. And so, granted, I'm interviewing a lot of really hot-running high school seniors, sometimes juniors. And I've given to ask them, there's a question that I have to ask them as part of the interview process about time management. And I ask them that, and then I look at sometimes some of their answers, and then I say, okay, completely unofficial question. How much time do you spend just in unstructured activities? Hang out with your family, hang out with your siblings, hang out with your friends, going out with your significant other, et cetera, et cetera. I'm like, I'm not going to put this answer in my report, but just let me know. And if they say, oh, yeah, I do that on the weekends, I say, good, keep on doing that. If they say, oh, I don't really have time for that because I'm captain of the cross-country team and I'm a science finalist and I play first violin for the orchestra, I'm like, whoa, you're going to give yourself a heart attack by the time you're 23. Stop. I said, you need to take a look at that, too. Like, it's, all those things are important, yes, but when you're 10, 20 years from now, you're not going to remember what you got on the biology final, but you will remember taking your girl to the movies. You will remember spending time just hanging out with your friends on a Saturday afternoon. And those are those human connections that really make us, well, human. And if you're not doing that, then you're probably not doing it right. You're probably going to risk burning yourself out. It's all about that equilibrium I talked about before.
All right. So we are nearly out of time. Is there anything else you want to say?
Nothing other than just thanks for having this opportunity, even though, as I was saying before we set up the interview, that I used to pass by this studio every day, or maybe not every day, at least once a week as a student here when picking up mail. And I was intrigued about what goes on there and never really had the time or the connections to participate in WRCT. And so it's a lot of fun actually being on the radio.
Well, thank you so much for coming by now. It's been a great time.
Well, thanks so much.
This has been Commander Hoffman. I've been Riona Duncan interviewing on WRCT Pittsburgh. Now we're going to get back into your regularly scheduled Whiskey Before Breakfast. And Amanda Richard does have an interview with Heather Pearson that you might want to stay tuned in for. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Dr. Ruth Westheimer. And if you listen to WRCT Pittsburgh, you know that in most cases, size does not matter.
All right, everybody, listen up. I got an announcement here from the Allegheny County Emergency Management Council. That's the Allegheny County Emergency Management Council. Are you in emergency? Call 911 if you can. Now text if you can. Now, Southwestern Pennsylvania wireless customers can send an SMX text message to 911 operator from a mobile device when they can't place a phone call. This feature allows people with hearing or speech impairments, as well as those in situations where it's unsafe to speak on the phone, to contact 911 operators. If you text 911, only send text messages. Multimedia files cannot be received by 911 operators. In the to field, enter the numbers 911 and the message. Include the address, location of the emergency, and type of help needed, such as the fire, the police, the ambulance. Click send. Be prepared to answer questions and follow instructions from the 911 operator. If you need to, place your phone on silent so as to not alert the intruders. Remember, do not text and drive, and use 911 services only in an emergency. Use an agency's regular phone line for a non-emergency call.
Spack Brothers Pizza joins you in supporting WRCT Pittsburgh. Spack Brothers Pizza offers pizza, hoagies, and wings while specializing in vegan and vegetarian alternatives. Spack Brothers Pizza uses no refined sugars in its sauce and unbleached flour in its dough. And they provide online ordering and payment, as well as contact-free pickup. You can learn more about online ordering at their website, www.spackbrothers.com, and you will receive a text message when your food is ready for pickup. For more information, call 412-362-SPAK or visit their website at spackbrothers.com. That's 412-362-7725 or spakbrothers.com. If you are interested in underwriting for WRCT, you can email pr@wrct.org for more information about promotional exchanges and other partnership opportunities.
Hey there, it's the Mockster from WRCT's own Friday night extravaganza, Viva La Mock, reminding you that you're listening to Whiskey Before Breakfast with my good friend, Mando Richard. But then again, unless you're a first-time listener, you probably already knew what you're listening to, right? Huh?